Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston, and join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
And of course, I'm the only one who reads that, because we've determined that you don't do that, so that's fine.
That's your job.
It's my job. And so, since it's my job, let me introduce the first topic. So what have we been doing this week? As we record this, we're finishing up the week that contained the Feast of the Assumption, which, in case you don't know, is a holy day of obligation still in the church. You wouldn't know it sometimes from the way the church fails to inform us of this fact, but it is a holy day of obligation, which commemorates the moment, the day, the time when the Blessed Mother was assumed into heaven,
body and soul,
at the time of, as we so diplomatically put it, the end of her earthly life. Did she die? Did she fall asleep?
Right. Because in the
opinions differ.
Because in the Eastern churches, they actually call it the dormition of Our Lady, which means literally falling asleep.
Good night. Whereas actually in the West, it was fairly common, like, it was pretty much she died. That was we've kind of backed off of that a little, I think. We've now kind of like, maybe she did, maybe she didn't. But I think we've kind of backed. I mean, there are places called the Tomb of Our Lady,
right.
You know, that claim to be the tomb. I saw someone, I didn't look it up, like, I didn't read it, but someone was pointed to this article that tried to tell the difference between why do we say that Jesus ascended and Mary was assumed? And I think it's because Jesus goes on his own power, but Mary is assumed into heaven through the power of Christ, through the power of her Son and the Holy Spirit and the Father.
Right. Ascend is a intransitive verb.
Jesus takes the stairs. Mary goes on the escalator.
Well, but I think ascend is intransitive. Like you.
Yes.
You ascend. That's something that you do. But to be assumed is something that is done to you.
Or intransitive.
Yeah.
Intransitive is you doing it. You're active,
right?
Intransitive is you're acting, being acted upon.
Well, I mean, sort of. I mean,
yeah, I never got that in grammar. I never figured out the difference between transitive and intransitive, which you can see how well I do with languages. Well, in any case, Mary, she took the holy escalator to heaven, powered by the Holy Spirit, and so we went to Mass. We almost never go to our parish for holiday masses because they never have a Mass at a time we can go.
Right. Our parish has a 6:45 a.m. Mass. That is never going to happen, ever. And then they have a 7 p.m. Mass. And, well, we could technically make that by the time.
Yeah.
It's like we'd have to rush dinner and then the kids are cranky. And I know a lot of people who work and that's the only Mass they can go to with their families.
And we would go to
make
that
it work
if that's what we had to do.
Right.
But we don't have to do that.
So we have a lot of options because we homeschool, because there are so many parishes.
Summer for most people around here, but mostly because there are so many parishes nearby.
Because there are lots of parishes nearby. So we went to St. Clair's, which is really, really close by. In fact, it's
frankly closer than our parish, the parish we go to.
I think St. Clair's is probably the closest church, geographically speaking.
No, St. Joe's is closer.
Okay. Anyway.
Yeah.
But we pass St. Clair's on our way to the grocery store.
within a 20-minute drive of our house, there's something like 10 Catholic parishes. I think when we were wandering around trying to find a new parish a few years ago, I think that's what it was. We could even go to the pastoral center, which is what we used to do. We'd go to the pastoral center, the headquarters of the diocese, which is in the same town as St. Clair's. They have a 12:05 Mass, but that's always packed on holy days.
Yeah, lots and lots of people do that.
Yeah, not just the employees, but lots of old people who come in for Mass, hoping to catch the Cardinal. So we used to do that, especially when I worked there. But yeah, we went to St. Clair's.
The kids kind of miss going to the Pastoral Center, actually.
Yeah, but that's at noon, so it's in the middle of the day. Right. So we got there, and the Mass was being said by Father Sean Carey. And Father Sean I believe, I'm not sure if it's still true, but at the time he was ordained, he was the first priest ordained who was deaf at the time of ordination. Profoundly deaf, like deaf from birth.
Well, if he was the first, then it would still be true that he was the first.
Well, I mean, he was the only, I'm sorry.
Right.
But I think he was the first. And he's the head of deaf ministry for the archdiocese, but helps out at the parishes in Braintree, you know, St. Clair's and St. Francis. Funny how that works out, for masses. And we've been to a mass with him before, and he does a sign language mass, which is he signs the prayers, and they have a deaf language interpreter who either reads the prayers from the book, or when he's giving his homily, they interpret his signs for us.
Right.
Which is an interesting experience.
And when the congregation is saying their responses, the interpreter interprets that for him so that he can see when the congregation has made their response.
Right.
And so it is a true dialogue, like the back and forth.
Right. So the first time we went to one of his masses, it was a guy who was interpreting. But this time it was a woman, which was a very odd experience to hear the words of consecration being said aloud by a woman's voice.
I didn't notice that at all. Like, it didn't even occur to me.
It was a little weird, but it doesn't matter. She's not saying the prayers. She's interpreting. There's a difference. There's a distinction. And he's saying the prayers. And so, and it's funny, if you see him, he does it one-handed. Most priests have to, they're supposed to do it two-handed. But the rubrics for sign language is an accepted language of the ritual. They've had an American Sign Language version of the general instruction, the rubrics, and so one-handed is acceptable because that's the only way he can say it. But think how interesting that is. The priest has to say the words of consecration for the bread and wine to become the body and blood of Jesus, and his hands say the words. It's very interesting.
It's very moving too. I don't know. Why? I mean, for me, I guess it's always kind of moving to hear Mass in a different language. This one, I wasn't actually hearing the Mass in a different language. I was watching it, and I'm not at all proficient in sign language. My brother's dating a deaf woman, and so I know a few signs, a very, very few signs. But actually watching him say the Mass, I feel like I've learned a few signs.
Yeah,
just because so much of the Mass is repetitive that you hear the same words over and over again. So after a while, you start to see the patterns. Well, and
even like some signs are very obvious what they are. So he did teach everyone the sign for Assumption, which is you hold out the palm of your, what do you say, dominant hand.
No, you hold your palm of your non-dominant hand out flat.
OK. And then you put flat. And then you, like a cloud. Then you put your two fingers of your dominant hand down, like the legs of a person.
Yeah, like you're making a little person on your hand.
If you could see us, you could see us doing it. And then you raise it up, above your head. And that's Assumption, which is also the sign for the Ascension. So we
noticed that during the Creed when he was doing, he ascended into heaven.
I like the sign for the dragon, because the first reading had the dragon about to devour the child from the woman clothed in the sun. And the dragon is... it's like Salt Bay. Have you ever seen that meme? Oh, Salt Bay.
No,
I
have no idea what you're talking
about. It's an internet thing. So it's basically like a puppet with your fingers in like kind of reared back. You bend your elbow.
Yeah, like make a sock.
Like you're making a sock puppet. If only you could see what I was doing when I was making that noise, that would make some sense. So basically it's like a sock puppet, and that's dragon. So that was kind of cool. And it's interesting how you pay more attention when you have to watch it to see what he's doing. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, so this is not a Mass that I'm likely to fall asleep during.
Yeah. And then he does his homily. The one thing with the homily was we felt like this interpreter, as opposed to the one he had on the previous Mass we went to, this interpreter was not interpreting everything.
I felt like there was definitely, he was saying like maybe
Twice as much.
Well, maybe not quite twice as much, but there was like
more than she was interpreting.
Yeah, there was a lot of things where he was clearly going on for quite a while. And then like she came out with a sentence, and I know that the different languages can have like a lag with you know, some things take longer to say in a particular language than others. Yeah, but
I felt like she was having trouble keeping up.
But yeah, I definitely get the sense that she was talking very quietly and she seemed to be kind of struggling a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing. She was talking very quietly. She was on a microphone, but she was talking. It was hard to hear her, actually, which is ironic. So we were able to go to Mass and that was good. And it was good to see Father Sean and to go to Mass with him again. It's very interesting. In fact, our friend Zena, who we've talked about before, she used to go to his Masses for the deaf community, which she said were very quiet, which, you know,
I think in the Masses that are for the deaf community,
they don't have an interpreter.
They don't have the interpreter and they don't have any music. So
no point in that.
Right. They tend to be very
quiet, which is great for especially like if kids have
sensory processing. Sensory
So, yeah, and you can bring your loud kids and that doesn't bother anybody. So, hey, folks, if you have a kid who's really loud, find the deaf mass that in your diocese and go to that.
I wonder how many dioceses have
I'm going to guess
masses in sign language.
I think in general, because there are so few deaf priests, if it's a mass for the deaf, it's interpreted. So you have a priest who's hearing, who says the mass out loud. And then they have an interpreter interpreting it.
Right.
Before Father Sean was ordained, Father, who was it? I forget his name. But they had a hearing priest who was head of the deaf ministry who could sign. So he signed the masses himself. So he did what Father Sean does, but he also spoke aloud.
So he said the words.
He's a hearing priest. He would say the words and sign.
Interesting.
Yeah. But so it was really neat. So the other thing that was big this week, the big event, was our anniversary. Happy 14th anniversary.
Yes.
Yes. We talked about that last week. And as we mentioned, we didn't really do anything. We got some takeout. We'll talk about that in a minute in our what we're eating segment. But we didn't do much. We didn't really do presents.
No presents.
So here's the thing with us. We're not really present people. Neither of us are language. Our love language is giving or receiving presents.
Yeah. And my family was always kind of like, presents were never a huge deal, I guess, when I was growing up. I mean, we always got presents, but they were never like my parents, you know, would give each other anniversary presents most of the time. But sometimes they would kind of come sometime afterwards. They would go out for their anniversary, but never almost never on the actual day of the anniversary.
Right, on the day that was convenient.
Right.
Because it makes sense, which makes perfect sense. So, yeah, I mean, I know for some people like these. Birthdays, anniversaries are huge. And if they don't get a gift or they don't get a really thoughtful gift, they don't get a card or flowers. It ruins the holiday. I mean, it is extremely important to them.
And it hurts their feelings. It hurts them. And they feel unloved.
I'm not invalidating that. That is a perfectly valid way of feeling. But that's neither of us.
Right.
And people don't believe, I don't buy you like a Valentine's gift. When I tell people like, oh, I didn't get anything for Valentine's, they're like, no, you're in big trouble. I'm like, no, really, I'm not.
Your mother is always really disturbed by this. And she thinks that you're like slighting me. And she's always trying to stand up for me and convince you that you need to be a better husband and like get me more stuff.
Well, gift giving is my mother's love language.
Very, very much.
My mother does not show up at this house without her hands full of a thing. And sometimes a thing that she brought last time. As we found out when she brought us the bird bath again, she brought us a bird bath. And then she later on another trip, she brought us
another one
of the same thing and had forgotten. And I forgot to give it back to her to give to because she was like, I thought I was missing one. I bought several of them and I didn't know what happened to it. So anyway, but yeah, so my mom, she's like convinced that I am somehow slighting you. Not giving you gifts. I'm like, no, really? She doesn't care.
But you did bring me random roses last week.
I did.
It was really nice.
Well, in fact, I think that's kind of cooler. Like random gifts, because, you know, if I give you a gift on the day of obligation, which is, you know, the anniversary or birthday or whatever, then it's like, oh, you've gotten me the thing and fulfilled your obligation. Bravo you. you know, whereas if I just get you a random gift, not that my calendar, my task list, my project management tool, OmniFocus, I may or may not have a buy Melanie flowers task on it periodically.
What? I don't believe you.
It sort of comes up randomly, just to sort of like, oh, yeah, I haven't done that in so long, so I should do that. It's on there. It's not like buy on this day, but it's like every once in a while, like, hey, have you ever thought of this? I'm like, oh, yes. My task list is my second brain. It's where I offload my brain. So it's
I'm always impressed by your ability to like to
manage things.
To manage tasks.
Oh, because I'm an organized person because I'm a profoundly disorganized person. That's people like, oh, you're so organized. I'm like, yeah, that's because I have to be, because otherwise I'll get nothing done. This is, I've learned this lesson the hard way.
Well, see, I'm a profoundly unorganized person, and I'm still a profoundly unorganized person.
You haven't run into the disaster of coming confronted with your disorganization, potentially destroying everything, which I
evidently not.
But yeah, so I have my task list, and that's where part of my brain resides. That's, I've just offloaded it to the computer. I'm a cyborg. So
I am not at all offended that buying me flowers is on the task list, because the fact that you took the time to put it there is really thoughtful and, you know, sweet.
Yeah. And then when it happens, you know, it comes up, I'm like, oh, yes, that's part of my brain reminding me. So that was our anniversary. Again, not it wasn't much. So let's talk about what we're eating, because what happened on our anniversary was we've talked about. Did we talk about the Jamaican place? I think we talked about it in previous episodes.
I don't know.
So in case we haven't, there is this place down the street from us. I gotta back up a bit. We live in a small town with 11,000 people. Okay. In this small town of 11,000 people, we have 8 pizza places.
Something like that.
It's like the town is like 4 miles by 3 miles wide. Like I'll put it in a little terms that are a little more easier to understand. In the United States, per capita, per 10,000 people, the average is 2 pizza places per 10,000.
He looked this up.
I looked this up. I wrote a blog post about this years ago because it's bothered me so much. In Massachusetts, we have the highest, Massachusetts has the highest concentration of pizza places, which is, I'm somewhat proud of, but at 6 per 10,000. At the time that I looked this up, we had 10 pizza places in a town of 11,000 people. We had not just Massachusetts is 3 times the national per capita. We have almost twice the per capita of Massachusetts. I mean, it's crazy how many pizza places. And of course, they're constantly going out of business because there's not enough business to support that many pizza places. And then a new pizza place opens up in the same place.
I think they say, well, the ovens are already here. And so, you know, it's already set up to be a pizza business.
Yeah. And no one comes along and goes, did you ever stop to wonder why the previous pizza place went out of business? Oh, their pizza's not as good as ours. Yeah. In the time we've lived here, in the 10 years that we've, or 11 years now, we've lived in this place, this one location down the street from us has had no fewer than 3 different pizza places close.
I thought it was like 4.
No, it's 3, because it was Partners, then it was Emilio's. Emilio's? No, not Emilio. It's not something with an E.
And then it was Natale's.
And then it was Natale's. Now it's this new place, which we were so excited when we saw going in, because we've always talked about, could someone open up something different than a pizza place? And we saw the sign called Everything Jerk. That's right. It is a Jamaican takeout restaurant. I was so excited.
But there is no other Jamaican.
I don't know where the
Caribbean place anywhere nearby.
I can't. Well, I don't know if there's another Jamaican place in the Boston metro area. This might be I have never heard of another Jamaican place around here.
Oh, I'm sure there probably is one in Boston.
I don't know. But I always wanted to go in there and go, hey, what Jamaican? And then he would respond, Everything Jerk.
And you'd say, who are you calling a jerk?
Exactly. Who are you calling a jerk? Yeah. But it would be a wonderful exchange. I wish I knew him that well. But anyway, but it's literally called Everything Jerk. Like no H, because with a Jamaican accent. So
We're not actually making fun of.
No, we're totally not making fun of the accent. That's what they did. So it's been open for about a month, and I've been wanting to go in, and I've been talking, you know, trying to convince you that we should go in.
I haven't been objecting. Just haven't got around to it.
Yeah. So one day I was out running an errand last week. Last Tuesday, I was out running an errand, and I'm driving back, and I'm like thinking, I want to stop and get some lunch. I want to get some lunch. You know, now it's lunchtime. As I'm driving by, I'm like, I'm just going to pull in and get some stuff. So I pull in, I go in. It's a totally takeout. It's just that it's a takeout. You can't, you know, there's no place to sit. It's a takeout place. You go in, and the guy's there, and his brother's there, and I think his other brother, his brother-in-law or something is in the back, and they've got everything, and it's really smells awesome. And so what? So I told them, look, I'm getting this for my wife and my kids. They've never had Jamaican food, and I want them to try it and enjoy it. So we got some fried chicken, and then some jerk chicken, some jerk pork, some patties, which are essentially every culture has a dish or a food, which is a pocket of dough with food stuffed inside. I mean, this is like the ultimate kind of food, whether it's an empanada or a pasty or
samosa
or like some others, dumpling, the dumplings from the Peking. Right.
These are more like
Chinese dumpling,
an empanada or a Cornish pasty,
right?
Like a British pasty. And I'm guessing the word patty probably comes from the British.
It's pasty? Probably right. It's probably patty, pasty, or pasty. I think it's pronounced pasty.
Pasty, yeah.
But in any case, so I got a curried chicken, one of those.
So good.
And so I got the jerk sauce on the side because I was a little afraid of being too spicy for some of the kids. I brought it home. Oh my gosh, they
it was like a feeding frenzy.
Loved it.
Like
Ben, our child who. Anything that was like who only ate white food for the longest time, pasta plain or bread or banana. Like it was, he loved it. He's like, I'm starting to like spicy food. I'm like, hallelujah.
I was shocked. He could have knocked me over with a feather that yes. He was eating this jerk chicken.
I mean, Bella, she tried some of this stuff. The fried chicken was about what she could eat.
Yeah, she did. She was not a big fan of
it. It was really good fried chicken.
KFC had better watch out if these guys. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, it blows KFC out of the water. No, I mean I'm talking. This might have been some of the best fried chicken I've ever had. It was really, really.
Yeah.
They had beans and rice, and you know, so a simple menu. They advertised like some dessert sort of things. They had fried plantains, and they had some desserts. But they're like a lot of barbecue places. What is available depends on the day to day and what they've been able to make and what they sell out of. They don't keep food over. So they make a certain amount. When it's gone, it's gone. You know, that's a fairly common barbecue place sort of thing. So they didn't have a bunch of the things. Well, this went over so well at lunchtime that I think you suggested, because I was trying, like, what do you want to do for dinner? We want to get something for our anniversary dinner.
Yeah, I was really stumped for what to do for dinner. I didn't feel like cooking really that much.
Right, so I said, well, we could get something in. And you said, well, can we get more of the jerk? I'm like, why not? And we suggested to the kids. I'm like, I'm not sure if they'll want more of that. And we suggested, they were like, yes. Oh, yeah, that would be awesome.
So we got the same takeout twice in a day.
We'd never done that before. We also had some frozen shrimp in the freezer.
Right. Well, that was the thing is you and Anthony bought the shrimp at the grocery store when you went.
Yes.
And I said, well, I like shrimp, too, but I'm not sure how to make a meal out of this with what I have in the pantry.
With what we had in the pantry. I mean, we have plenty of recipes for shrimp dishes, but for what we had on hand. But
I would have had to go to the grocery store.
Anthony just wanted to have shrimp cocktail.
But I can't, like shrimp cocktail is not a meal.
No, it's an appetizer.
Right.
Right. So we thawed the shrimp, made up some cocktail sauce, had some leftover, and then I went out again. Back to the place. The evening shift was the guy I saw in the morning or in the afternoon. The evening shift is his wife, his mother, and his sister-in-law or something like that. It's totally a family run operation. And I got a bunch more of the stuff. And this time I got the beef patty, which I liked. You weren't as much a fan of. You liked chicken better.
I liked the chicken curry better.
And then we got more of the jerk chicken, the jerk pork.
The fried chicken.
Fried chicken. Did we get anything else? I don't think I got anything else. I tried to get like the fried plantains and the other stuff. They didn't have any of that. But
I was sad. I really wanted some fried plantains.
Yes, but it was really, really good the second time. So the Jamaican jerk was a hit. And then that wasn't the end of our barbecue for the week, because you had previously purchased some baby back ribs. For at the grocery store. So we had pulled that out and had already started defrosting them. And it takes, I need 36 hours to put the rub on and let them soak up the rub. And I hadn't done it yet because I got to time it with the weather. And so that we did on the other day. And that came out really good. We've made it a few times before. The kids really love it. It takes all day. So I started at 11 in the morning and it's done by dinner. So
Yeah, and I like that because it's you cooking and I just made a couple right. sides.
And it goes, it's like on the grill for half the time and in the oven for the other half of the time. But you can't really overcook it. Like, you don't burn it. You can't burn it. But it was in the oven for too long, so it's kind of fallen off the bone a little too much. Like, I like it tender, sort of falling off
the bone. You like to actually have to, use your teeth to get it off the bone?
I like to be able to cut it. Not shred it. Like, it basically shredded as I was.
It was almost like pulled pork.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a little longer than I wanted to, but the taste was really good. I had the hickory chips and all that sort of stuff. So that was really good. So really happy that we made some barbecue sauce to go with it because the barbecue sauce we had on hand was just the stuff that Lucy can't eat because it has cornstarch in it from the store. So we made some, which was okay. It was kind of sweet.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan. It was okay.
Yeah, I prefer the more darker Texas style barbecue sauce, not the sweet tomatoey.
As is correct and proper.
Well, of course,
Texas style is the correct barbecue.
I know who I'm sitting next to, folks. I know how to talk about this stuff. All right. So, and then you made a dessert.
Yes, I did. I made this blueberry cake. Except it's kind of almost a cheesecake.
Yeah, I mean, there's hardly any flour in it.
So, yeah, this was one of those sponsored posts on Facebook from King Arthur Flour. Like, it worked. Basically an advertisement.
It worked on her.
And I saw the picture and it looked really yummy. And so I saved it. And so it had ricotta cheese and sour cream and eggs and like 3/4 of a cup of flour for the entire cake. So almost no flour at all and only 1/2 cup of sugar. So it was actually a really low carb cake and with blueberries sprinkled on top. And it was really light and fluffy and yummy.
Mm. Yes, it was very good. I think it's just about gone. There's like a tiny little bit left, but
they saved you a little crumb.
They did. Thank you. The funny thing is you showed me the picture from the ad. Like, there was no way that the cake in the ad used the same amount of blueberries that are in the ingredient listing for the recipe.
Yeah. They,
that was like 4 times the amount of blueberries.
The picture in the cake in the picture had a lot more blueberries than mine did, which
I wouldn't have
been opposed to.
Well, I think that might've been too much. I mean, it might've made it too swooshy.
Too wet.
Yeah. This was just the right amount. I think this was a really good recipe. And again, it wasn't all, like, very heavy in flour. It was really good. I mean, which is, you looked at the calories, like each slice was like under 200 calories.
Yeah, I think it had a serving suggestion of 10 slices and it was like 240 calories per slice. But we did 12 slices, which brought it in at just 200 calories a slice.
Nice.
Yay.
Dessert and feel good about it, too. And then last night, my mom came over for the day and she stayed for dinner and we made one of my favorite dishes, shakshuka. Which basically it's from, what did I say? It was a Turkish word meaning a muddle or a mixture.
And it wasn't Turkish. It was like
Arabic, Tunisian Arabic slang word or jargon word for a muddle or a mixture. Shaka. And it's basically this shakshuka is one of those dishes where you find it throughout the Mediterranean and it can be anything. But basically, your version is what?
My version came from a cookbook called Mediterranean Hot, which basically is like really spicy food.
You got that before we met, right?
Yeah, I got
it. But it was prophetic because you would eventually marry Mediterranean Hot.
Uh-huh. I got it at Half Price Books back when I lived in Texas. And there are a couple recipes from this book that are like among my favorite things in the world. The shakshuka and the moussaka.
Mm-hmm. Yes, both very good.
So basically, you cut up a bunch of different kinds of peppers, bell peppers, jalapenos,
Cubanelles,
anyway, whatever kind of peppers you've got.
Anaheims. Yeah. Whatever like the grocery store has, just get a bunch of different ones.
Yeah.
Not all spicy ones, though.
Right. You don't want it to be too spicy.
Right.
So you saute some diced onion and then the peppers. And then you pour over it a bunch of grated tomato.
Grated, which is the important.
Yeah. So you buy the really big, gigantic beefsteak tomatoes.
And very ripe.
Very ripe. You cut them in half. And then you take the half and you put the cut side against the grater and you grate. And then all you're left with, like you grate until all you're left with is the skin. And you throw the skin away. And now you've got all the tomato pulp. and it's like in texture, it's like the can of crushed tomatoes, but the flavor is a lot brighter and fresher.
Right, because the crushed tomatoes have been cooked, and this has not been cooked yet.
Right. And so then you just saute your, you cook it until the tomatoes have lost some of their liquid, and then you crack some eggs on top. Make
little wells in the top of it, yeah.
You just poach some eggs on top in the tomato juice.
So when the whites are set, you're pretty much done. And then you serve it with crusty bread.
Yeah. So there's an Italian version that my friend Rebecca likes to make, and called
Uova.
Eggs in Purgatory.
Uova in Purgatorio.
Which is such an Italian name. I love it.
Yes, the eggs are in purgatory.
But because I got it from this cookbook that calls it Chukchuka, and her recipe is based on one, an Israeli recipe.
Yes, this is close to the standard Israeli version that you would find. But there are even ones like have no tomato. It's all like Swiss chard, like greens instead of tomato. It's really fascinating, the variations. I was looking them up last night. But it's one of my favorite dishes. Sophie loves it. I love it. You love it.
And that's about it.
And that's about it. The others all complain.
Ben and Isabella ate some mac and cheese, and
Lucy had
leftover ribs, and then Anthony, I don't even know what
he sat and complained.
He complained for a long time.
Until we gave him a little bit of the ribs, and then, I don't know what he eventually...
Oh, no, he ended up eating some smoked salmon that was in the fridge.
Right, you gave him a big hunk of smoked... Like, he had like a $20 hunk of smoked salmon or something. Maybe not that much, but he had a big hunk of smoked salmon.
Yeah.
We get it at the farmer's market in bulk. They sell these big bulk packages, and it's, you know, it's expensive in aggregate, but... It's cheaper than the stuff at the supermarket, and it's much better.
It's really fresh. It's really flavorful. Yeah. And it's definitely cheaper than the supermarket stuff.
Right. But the amount of it that he ate was probably more expensive than the rest of the meal. But
that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a treat.
He loves salmon, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's getting him to eat something decent. Sometimes he complains so much, and I will never tell him this, but sometimes he complains so much, I'll just give him anything, whatever he wants, feed it to him. So
this is bad parenting. Give in to the whining and complaining.
But don't let him know that you've given in, that's for sure.
Right.
Someday when he listens back to these podcasts, he'll know. Gotcha, Anthony. All right, so that's what we've been eating. What we've been watching and reading. So I want to talk about two things I've watched, and then you can talk about the two books you've read. So the first thing I watched this week was a recent movie called Alita: Battle Angel. It's based on a graphic novel, as everything else is. And it takes place in a cyberpunk future, 600 years in the future. The world is kind of devastating. And then there's a city that floats above this, about a city of the elites that floats above the city of the downtrodden. And
this sounds familiar.
And everybody has cybernetic enhancements, replacements, even to complete replacement where brains are implanted into cybernetic bodies. And so this scientist discovers a cybernetic body in the dump. He rebuilds it. It's a Pinocchio story, essentially, where he rebuilds it. Alita discovers who she is in the course of it and discovers.
Or a Pygmalion story?
A little bit of Pygmalion and Pinocchio. Yeah, there is a little bit of that. And one of the interesting things about it. So as far as the CGI goes, the special effects, I mean, there's very much an uncanny valley aspect to it. Like the Alita character, it's a woman playing the character, but it's almost entirely CG. Like the eyes are just way too big for a human being, right? Which is, I think, an intentional thing. They said, uncanny valley, I'll show you uncanny valley. You know what I mean? They knew there was going to be an uncanny valley, so they embraced it.
Interesting.
So I think there was some of that. But one of the interesting things about this is this character, she was completely self-giving, selfless. She was constantly trying to do for others without thinking of herself.
Interesting.
And expecting others to be as selfless as she is. I mean, she was sort of a pure character. And yet, no spoilers, but there's an irony in that we discover. About her origin and who she really is and that sort of stuff. So it's very interesting. And then there's this whole thing about, you know, wanting to ascend into the higher city and no one ever gets to go, but some people are actually being promised and what's the deal? And people who fall from there, you know, they fall from heaven down to below. And one character actually says at one point, it is better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. Yeah, I mean, it's literally like it's not very subtle at all on that mark.
But thematically, that actually ties in with the book I'm reading.
So interesting. OK, so that I'd say that was pretty good. I liked it a little bloody. I mean, like it's cartoonish in some cases, but it's not super gory, but it is violent. There's violence. It is Battle Angel.
Yeah.
So there's that. All right. And then I watched another movie on Netflix called Red Sea Diving Resort, starring Chris Evans, Captain America. And it's based on a true story. And I'll put a link in the show notes about an article I found that describes it. So what happened is in Ethiopia for thousands of years, mm-hmm. the descendants of the Queen of Sheba, quote unquote, they claim a traditional claimed descendants of Queen of Sheba who visited King Solomon. They uh-huh. claim to be Jews. They have been Jews living there, separated from Jews, the European and Middle Eastern Jews for millennia.
But people of the book.
People of the book. I mean, the people of King David. And around 1980, there was the Ethiopian Civil War. And as always happens to Jewish people, they end up being attacked by both sides, persecuted in the middle. And, right. you know, they get downtrodden. And so a lot of them were refugees trying to get away and end up in refugee camps in Sudan. Now, Israel, which, again, let's keep in mind, we're only about 1979, 1980, not too far removed from World War II and the founding of the nation of Israel, they still have these ties. They're like, anybody who wants to come can come. That's their thing. So they want to bring all these people to Israel. The problem is it's Sudan. Sudan is part of the Arab League. It's a radical Muslim government. They may have no love for Israel. In fact, they pledged as part of the Arab League to destroy Israel. So they're not going to help. So long story short, Mossad comes up with this plan to secretly lease a closed Italian diving resort on the Red Sea that had been built in the early 70s, to secretly lease it from the Sudanese government, Ministry of Tourism.
Wait, they released it directly from the Sudanese?
Oh, yeah, through a shell corporation in Europe, like a Swiss shell corporation. They leased it and ran it as a diving resort with real tourists. But at night, they would bring hundreds of these refugees from the camps through the resort onto inflatable boats and drive them out to a ship at sea. And then the ship would take them up the Red Sea to the port of Eilat. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Eilat, and bring them there. Over the course of in real life, over the course of several years, they actually had several different iterations of this over the course of 15, 16 years. They brought 20,000 Ethiopian Jews to Israel.
Wow.
A lot. I mean, and it's so moving because as they talk about what government, you know, they spent tens of millions of dollars, put all of their military might behind this, their top flight spy agency, put themselves in the line in the line of death for humanitarian reasons, to save their brothers in faith. That was it. That's why there was no overarching political gain for the nation. Nothing like that. It fascinating. And so the story, the movie, actually, there's elements of the movie, of course, fictionalizes it and compresses it and
right.
condenses it as the movie has to do. We can't tell the giant story, but it does it very well. So a couple of things I was, you know, is it violent? Yes, there are people die. People get shot, but nothing too gory. There isn't a whole lot of blood. There isn't a lot of on screen, like really gory stuff. There is no sex in it at all. There is some naked posterior going on.
Okay.
We do in Avengers Endgame. They at one point they refer to Chris Evans as behind as America's butt.
Okay.
And we do see the side of America's butt. But you know, that's about it. I mean, it's not, no frontal whatever, no love scenes or anything like that. So it's so nothing offensive like that. And just it's really, really good. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I thought, and especially when at the end, I went and looked it up and read about what really happened.
Uh-huh.
And it was really good. So I got to recommend that. And check out this article that I linked to. It tells a story from the point of view of the woman who was the general manager of the resort. She ran much of the operation, which is fascinating in a country that was a very strict Muslim nation and that women downtrodden and all that whole thing.
Interesting.
Yeah. I don't want to underplay. It's a rough movie. I mean, there's some bad men in it and they do bad things to people. And a lot of it happens off screen, but there's some rough language between them. So I don't want you to be so shocked if you watch this and there's rough talk among people, you know, and you see someone get shot on screen. I mean, that's going to happen. But I've seen much worse lately. Like, remember when I talked about The Boys, that Amazon series, the superhero series? This is not that. Certainly the other side of the world from that. So,
OK,
so those are the two things I watched. What have you been reading?
Yes, I haven't really been watching anything at all. But I've been reading a lot this week. I finished a book in like 2 days. That was one that I had got for Isabella for Christmas, I want to say, or maybe her birthday. I like to read juvenile fiction and keep up with what the kids are reading. I can never keep up with Isabella's reading because she reads very fast and she has a lot more free time than I do.
And she's currently working herself through the Time Life Civil War series.
Yes. Right now, her current obsession since we got back from Gettysburg is the Time Life Civil War series, which she found at the library. And she's trying to read her way through that. And I'm
tooled leather covers.
Yes.
I remember that from the TV ads.
Yeah. Very fun. Anyway, so the novel I'm read was The Crystal Snowstorm, which is the first in a, what do you call it, a series of four? Tetralogy?
Quadrology?
I think tetra.
Sure.
Anyway, it's a series of four novels that were written by a Catholic novelist, Mariel Trevor, who wrote in the first part of the 20th century. And she was very prolific, but isn't very well known today. And I discovered her. Some of her books have been reprinted recently by Ignatius Press, a couple of historical novels about John Henry Newman, probably because of the upcoming canonization. Ignatius has been on the ball. And some of her juvenile novels have been reprinted by a couple of Catholic companies. I want to say Bethlehem Books, but I might be wrong.
We'll have links in the show notes.
Yeah. Anyway, so The Crystal Snowstorm is the first in this series of books, and it takes place in a fictional small European country called Lechtenstein, which might make you think about Liechtenstein. And I think that that's deliberate. And it's somewhere between France and Germany. The people in this fictional country speak a mixture of French and German. Right. So it's basically Liechtenstein. It's a Catholic duchy. And the main character in this novel is an English girl. She was raised in England, but her mother was from Lechtenstein. And it turns out that she's the granddaughter of the Duke. And there is a conflict over the succession of the country. And so her grandfather calls her, like summons her. She's never been out of England before. She's 13 years old, which is Isabella's age. And so she's summoned to make an appearance at court, the court of her grandfather, who she's never met. And so she goes. It's Christmas time. She meets all of these relatives she's never met. She gets caught up in what is almost a civil war. It's right at the time of right after the French Revolution and Napoleon. And so there's a lot of concern in Europe at the time of the novel is set about revolutions. And her grandfather is very paranoid. And anyway, it's a great action adventure story for kids. Nothing in it that I wouldn't let Isabella or Sophie read. It's aimed at kids. There's a little bit of a romance, but not for the main character. I mean, she's 13. She's just watching the adults fall in love and get married. And it was fun. I really am looking forward to reading the rest of the series.
Good. And you'd recommend this for a 13-year-old girl?
I would recommend it for, 11, 12, 13, and up.
Yeah. You like it.
I liked it. and I generally recommend, Mariel Trevor is kind of hard to find. A lot of her books are out of print, but she's really worth looking up. She's great. I first read a book by her called Sun Slower, Sun Faster, which is about two children in 1950s.
S-O-N or S-O-U-N?
S-U-N.
Okay.
Two children in 1950s England who travel back in time. They live in this big house and they travel back in time and learn about history. It turns out that their family is Catholic, although neither one of them was raised Catholic. And they go back in a bunch of jumps and meet a whole bunch of different ancestors who are all Catholic, going all the way back to Roman Britain.
Wow. Interesting.
So a great way of learning about sort of a little bit of bits and pieces of England as a Catholic, historically Catholic country.
So, and then the other book that you are currently reading is a much different, much bigger book.
Yes. So sort of the other end of the spectrum, Crystal Snowstorm I read in 2 days. This one is probably going to take me all week. And that's because I'm not going to read anything else.
When she says it says it's going to take her all week, for normal people, that's like, it's going to take me a month to read this.
It's 800 and something pages long.
It's a big, thick Neal Stephenson novel.
Right. So Neal Stephenson, fantasy, not fantasy, science fiction, cyberpunk author, and definitely not safe for kids.
Yeah.
It's pretty violent. There's sex and stuff. I mean, not a lot, but some.
Adult themes.
This is the sequel to Reamed, which I read earlier this year.
R-E-A-M-D-E, which was in the story a typo of Read Me.
Right.
In the story. So Reamed, R-E-A.
So this is called Fall, and it's definitely a sequel. Like the main characters are all pretty much the same. And I really can't talk about it without spoilers.
You should see her all day here. Like, I really want to tell you about this and that and the other thing. I'm like, I might read this someday. So you can't really tell me.
And I want him to read it. And I know that if I spoil it, he probably won't pick up the book.
This book sounds like it's up my alley. It's, you know, it's international intrigue, spy novel, military fiction,
the first one was much more like international intrigue spy. This was very much more focused on computers and sort of future virtual reality computers, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, both of them sound a little up my alley. Right. I mean, you did kind of ruin Seven Eves for me. And I know how I can't read that now because I know how it all works.
Sort of, not really.
But I'll watch the inevitable Netflix or Amazon
series. Oh, don't know. But Stevenson is a great novelist. He's a novelist of ideas, and he's very much interested in exploring big topics like cryptocurrency and systems of knowledge and information, and how do we organize our understanding of the world around us.
But I almost find it intimidating in the sense of, not that I wouldn't understand, but just like, tell me a good story. Like sometimes I find that some of these high concept science fiction novelists, which I read a lot of science fiction, and some of them I'm just like, you know, dude, I'm sure this is fascinating. You did a lot of fascinating research on you know, cryptocurrency or cryptography, but tell me a good story.
No, but Stevenson definitely does that. This is like edge of your seat storytelling. Reamed was like, I can't put this novel down because I have to find out what happens next, because it is like edge of your seat.
I'm also a little wary of giant books these days. Like I read Brandon Sanderson's first book of his Stormlight Archive series earlier this year, and it took me forever. I'm like, I just want to finish this book and move on to these books that are piling up that keep coming in.
I guess
so. There's a little of that. You are a much faster reader.
I'm a pretty fast reader. So, I mean, I'm a little bit intimidated by big novels. Like I read
Tolstoy.
Brothers Karamazov earlier this year. That actually took me several months to read.
Yeah. Well, and plus you also read several books at the same time.
Right.
So you go between them as it interests you. All right. It will go on my list, and because you've recommended both of them so much to me. Do we own Read Me? Is that on Kindle?
I think I checked it out from the library on Kindle.
I'll have to check it out on the Kindle, on the Overdrive. All right. Okay. Anything else you've been reading?
I've been reading lots of poetry books and sort of how-to poetry books.
And writing poetry. And asking my input on poetry. I was like, wow. I was very honored to be asked for my input.
Well, I try not to abuse that privilege, because I know that if I hand you everything I write, you'll get burned out. Your eyes will glaze over and drool will start coming out of your mouth.
I like a certain amount of poetry. It's, you know, within a certain amount. I don't read poetry for fun like you do. But anyway, all right. So I'm really excited to get onto this next part of our show because it's feedback time. We've got some really cool feedback from some listeners, and I wanted to talk about some of them. And our first feedback comes from Heather in Bemidji. And I don't know if I would always just say where people are from, but I just love the name Bemidji. It's just such a cool name, Bemidji, Minnesota. I have to confess, I wasn't sure whether it was, when I wasn't looking at the email, whether it was Bemidji, Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Michigan, because I get those three confused a lot. You know how New England is the five states, Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and so they all kind of go together? There should be something that puts Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota together. There should be a name for them.
Maybe there is, and we just don't know it.
Well, I mean, some people they would say, oh, the Upper Midwest, but that's a little vague.
Right.
That could include, I don't know, Ohio. Not really. What's to the west of Minnesota or in Wisconsin? I forget. Anyway, but no, maybe it is my Upper Midwest. Anyway, let's go to Heather's email before I wander too far off. She says, thanks for putting together Raising the Bets. I'm enjoying it. Well, you're welcome.
Yay.
She says, my 13-year-old daughter introduced me to it after she heard about it from Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which she listens to with my husband. And that's where I've talked about it actually a few times. So that's, I'm very glad to hear that that works. That when I say, by the way, if you like this show, maybe you'd be interested in listening to that show. So I'm glad to hear that that works. She says, we're new Catholics, just converted 3 years ago. Welcome.
Yay.
And homeschool our 6 kids, 13 to almost 1. Wow, that's a good spread. It's fun to listen to you chat about areas where we have common ground. So writing mostly to thank you, but a couple of quick ideas too. One, we have the same issue with having only cell phones. We talked about going out if we right. want to go on a date, but one of the things that's a problem if we leave Isabella to watch the others is we don't have a house phone and Bella doesn't have a phone. So what do we do? And so she says, when we go on dates, we just leave one of them home with the kids. So we could leave your phone home here with Bella.
Right.
Which then we'd have to give her, like, put her thumbprint on it or give her the passcode. So the phone's locked. You know, that's...
Actually, I think my passcode is the same as the passcode on the iPad she uses, so that wouldn't be too hard for her to remember.
Okay, I just got, like, a cybersecurity shiver. Okay, we'll move on from that before I get any more nervous. So, writing mostly... Okay, we already did that. About neighbor kids. We talked last time about mm-hmm. the problem with neighbor kids, which seems to be... have solved itself a little bit, but we'll talk about the second. I think being firm but kind about your family's rules, which need to be followed by anyone visiting as well, will hopefully be understood by the littles who are crashing the party so often. Something like, our family rule is love, so if you want to play here, you need to be loving to your sister. That's actually a really good idea.
That is.
And maybe putting out a do not disturb signal on the front porch, a door hanger, a certain flower pot placed on the front step. That would be kind of a code to let them know when you're not available. And if they still knock, you don't have to answer. But put up a sign that says, go away, R and A. Anyway, thanks for the inspiration. We'll support you if we can. And thank you so much, Heather. We really appreciate that very much.
Although I don't think that they might not be able to read. So,
well, yes, they're a little young to read. But if we said there was a signal, like so if you see... a tie hanging on the front door knob. I don't know.
This sounds suspiciously like signals that people would put on like dorm rooms when I was in college.
Yes. So maybe not. But it's a good idea, actually, like a signal, like, you know, because what you want, you'd like to say is when it's dinner time, but everyone has dinner at different times. When it's between these hours, but they don't tell time, I don't think. They're so young. So I don't know. Yeah, but some kind of signal. We'll hang a flag. We'll hoist the signal flag outside, the quarantine flag outside.
The kids would like that.
Yeah, so it would be a Smalls and Amazons moment. So, Heather, thank you for your feedback. We really do appreciate it. And welcome to the listening audience. So, and then our friend Jenny.
Jenny.
We both know. We visited last year when we were on our big around the country vacation. And Jenny says she said she's been saving up her feedback and finally got around to sending it to us. So this is going to cover a few different things. She goes, a walkable community. We talked about that, I think, in our first episode. I had a chuckle over the idea that the close store was closed. So you had to drive an entire mile to the actual grocery store for milk. Well, it's like 2 or 3 miles. She says, I live in a large 400-house subdivision where driving a mile from my house does not even get you out of the neighborhood. The gas station convenience store is 3 miles away, and a real grocery store is over 6 miles. Funny how perspectives of distances change depending on what you're accustomed to. As for an ideal walkable community, my children decided after visiting that Delaware, Ohio was the perfect town. I agree. Remember me saying that?
Delaware was really cute.
We both went to Delaware, Ohio, too. You know, our family that was on our round the country vacation trip last year. And we both agreed that it looks like the perfect town to live in. Wide sidewalks, easy walk to stores, ice cream downtown. What more could you want? Even though it's been 5 years since we've been, every place we go with a wide sidewalk elicits a sigh from the older girls. This reminds me of Delaware. I can imagine it. Our neighborhood, of course, has no sidewalks at all. Our neighborhood has sidewalks. But often people don't use them.
Yeah.
Sometimes
they're in bad shape.
Not as bad as Salem's sidewalks. Remember the brick sidewalks?
Yeah, those are
horrible. Trying to push a stroller over those.
But our sidewalks, some of them are blocked by like basketball hoops.
Or trash barrels. Put the barrel on the grass next to the road.
And then in some places, like the snow plows have kind of push dirt and gravel and sod onto the sidewalk.
It's just accumulated and no one's ever cleared it off. Or the overgrown bushes.
Yeah.
people.
People in our neighborhood don't tend to see the sidewalk as something that they have to keep clear for pedestrians.
As a public way. It's really weird. Anyway.
But it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because then people who do take walks in the neighborhood walk in the middle of the street. And then therefore there is no need to clear the sidewalks. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay, she goes on. Civil War battlefields. Around here, you can't throw a rock without hitting a Civil War site. Jenny lives in the South. The national battlefields are really very well done. One of the more interesting days in my life was spent at Shiloh National Battlefield trying to figure out which mass grave my Confederate great-great-great-grandfather had been buried in. We eventually narrowed it down to 2 candidates. It drives home the realities of war. It does do that, actually. That's one of the things about Gettysburg that really...
Yes.
Drove down.
I think it was sobering for the kids. I think that they sort of had some epiphanies like about how horrible war was that they hadn't really had before.
Like, most kids don't. Yeah.
And I really felt like they were very thoughtful for a few days after we went to Gettysburg, and you could really see them kind of mulling things over and talking about things.
There is value in going to these places in teaching a younger generation. The war is terrible. The war is not glorious. We serve, we fight because we have to, you know, because someone needs to sometimes, but it is not glorious. And which is when you look at the historical records about when we watch the Civil War documentary, the Ken Burns documentary, how many men joined thinking it was going to be a glorious romp in battle.
Right.
Like, talk about somewhat delusional.
War
is not glorious.
You know, that actually reminds me of something that the narrator in Brideshead Revisited says. Like, when he first joins up during the Second World War, he's got this very glorious idea of war. And he sort of rattles off a list of all the, like, famous battles and heroes that he grew up reading about. And it seemed to be sort of inculcated by a certain kind of education that was maybe less critical about war. And we, of course, are the post-World War generations. And so we've grown up with that narrative of war is hell.
Yeah.
That I think that generations before the First and Second World War, just they didn't have that narrative at all.
That's true. Before the First and Second World War, even in Britain, they had wars in Europe. I mean, that they had fought in before World War One. I mean, in here, certainly people, you know, there wasn't that much time between Civil War, Spanish-American War, and the First World War.
Right. But I think there's something about modern warfare, which.
Like the Civil War was the first modern war in a sense.
Which made people more like there was sort of an epiphany about.
How horrible it was. I guess.
I mean, just from a literary point of view, you don't really see. The like war is horrible until maybe beginning with the Civil War.
Right.
And in Europe with the world wars.
Well, yeah. I mean, the wars did not become as much of a grinder, a destroyer of people as quickly as we really perfected killing with starting.
But I also think that there was a tendency to, like, the horrors of war didn't make it as much into the popular consciousness.
I think stuff didn't get back to, well, certainly the photographs that came out of Gettysburg, for instance, which was
right.
The first battles that was really heavily photographed. Those photographs, I think, really brought it home to people who, by and large, most people didn't ever see a battlefield, so they didn't know how bad it was. So there could be something to that. And then, second to last, she says, on religious ESPN, remember we talked about the basketball player who became a poor Claire nun?
Right, right.
That story. Right, she says, I think ESPN covers religion well because sports is the last area of society where people are allowed to be openly religious. On the whole, Tim Tebow notwithstanding, the players freely express religious beliefs without mocking repercussions. I think the sports reporters are accustomed to the language of religion and how it motivates the players they cover. You wouldn't think the guy covering the basketball game would have a better understanding of religion than the general reporter, but there it is.
That's an interesting insight. And I think that she's right, that there's an acceptance of religion in sports.
Well, I'm going to say, I hope it's not controversial, I think there's an acceptance of religion from African-American culture, from African-Americans, that there isn't as that wouldn't be as much from non-Africans and Caucasian Americans standard, which is, I think, the Tim Tebow thing. Tim Tebow was very vocally religious, but because he's white, I think that got mocked more than, say, when who is the quarterback for the Seattle Seahawks who publicly stated that he was going to remain a virgin till marriage. We beat him several times in the Super Bowl. Anyway, not to rub it in or anything, but I think there's a general acceptance of faith as a normal thing to be expressed out loud in the African American culture.
I think it's broader than that, though. I mean, I think that in general,
sports in general is more accepting of faith.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. I mean, NASCAR certainly is, and it's certainly a bastion of white people. Not a lot of black people involved in NASCAR. There's a few black drivers, but I guess I'm trying to think of it. I'm trying to think of. I mean, I can see the point, but I still think that there's a little bit of, because so many of the athletes in the NBA, the NFL, and the Major League Baseball are African American. I think that kind of helps. I mean, that's certainly a good thing. I think it's healthy that African American culture is so accepting of publicly expressed faith. I think that's great. I wish that was true for everyone. But also, I think it might be regional too. I don't think you hear as much public expressions of faith from, say, players in New England as you do.
Well, In general, I think the coasts tend to be less vocal about faith than the interior, and especially than the South.
Right.
And
a lot of professional players, especially in football, I have to say, come from the middle part of the country in the South.
Right. Yeah. So, but I think you're kind of colored by being a New Englander in some ways.
But colored in seeing how I my impressions of it, I guess. It's an interesting thing to think about, and maybe we'll talk about it some more in the future. And then finally, she says, on annoying neighbor children, no advice, but I've been there. They moved, thank goodness. We can always hope. Well, apparently Anthony was playing baseball today with R.
Yeah.
So he was saying that during prayers, thanking God for playing baseball with R.
I think in general, the neighbor children have cottoned on to the fact that our kids aren't as willing to play with them. And I think maybe they even got a little bit upset at having their grandparents told that they were cutting off flowers.
Well, yeah.
So
they shouldn't have been.
Right. So I'm wondering if maybe there was some sort of social repercussion by which they...
Bella did say they came by again today and wanted to play. And Bella and Sophie were like, nah. What did she say? We tried to be as polite as we could. Could you please go home now?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, it's polite and direct.
I think that with these particular children, direct, like, yeah, they finally learned
subtle is not going to work.
Subtle isn't going to work. You have to just be forthright and, you know, polite, but you can't beat about the bush. You have to just say no.
Yeah.
Go home.
All right. Well, we've talked long enough. We're over an hour now, so we should probably wrap it up.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but thank you both, Jenny and Heather, for your feedback. We love to hear from you. So we'd love to hear from you, listener. So what do you think of any of these topics we've talked about? Or if you have suggestions for books or TV shows or movies or anything like that, too, we want to hear from you. So you can go to sqpn.com/bets or the SQPN Facebook page at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or you can send us an email to bets, B-E-T-T-S, at sqpn.com. You'll find the links from the discussion, links to the books and movies we talked about, and that article I mentioned on the Operation Brother, the Red Sea Diving Resort.
Mm-hmm.
Check that out. And so you can find all that at sqpn.com. If you can, remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page, retweet it on Twitter where we're at SQPN, leave comments. It's called engagement, social media engagement. Engagement is a signal to Facebook and Twitter that it should show this to more people so that we don't have to pay them money, so that people who've already liked us can see our content. It's perverse, but it's the way it is, the way the world it is now. And we really appreciate it if you help us with that. And if you like the show, give us a rating in iTunes, Google Play, or any place you can give ratings to podcasts. We really do appreciate that. Again, all those things help us get the word out, because we don't have a budget to advertise the show. And so you're the only way other people hear about it. So we really do appreciate it. So anyway, until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.